Let me start with some thanks, because I arrived yesterday. I'm already enjoying immensely being here. I've met interesting people, and it seems that I knew them since a long time while we just met. So this is really great. So thanks for the invitation. I think that Sham started to talk about accounting in terms of rethinking the tyranny of shareholders' value, if you like. What I would like to do with my presentation, drawing on what has been written in the newsletter, is to question the trust and tyranny of transparency, which is at the core of any accounting framework at the moment. So if you open whichever textbook of financial reporting you open, the first chapter will have a picture which is similar to this, where financial reports are useful for shareholders, customers and suppliers, managers, auditors, investors, banks, governments, for very specific reasons. I mean, shareholders want to know whether they will get some returns out of their investment. Customers and suppliers want to know whether you know, the firm with which they are having relationships are solid. Managers want to use information for decision making, and so forth and so on. This in theory. Okay, let's see what happens instead in practice, and whether this idea of transparency, whether this idea that financial reports can make this relationship transparent and can provide information that is useful for these stakeholders is true or not. And I'm Italian, and so it's obvious for me to talk about something that I know, and this in particular is the Parmalat scandal. And so let's see who are the real people behind these boxes that the accounting frameworks frames. The first one is Callisto Tanzi, who is the owner of Parmalat and main shareholder of Parmalat. Then there is the manager, the CFO. The guy is not the guy with the blue hat, that is the policeman who is arresting the manager. So the manager is Fausto Tonna. Then we've got the banks involved in the scandal, all the big foreign banks, but also all the main Italian banks, Banca Intesa, Capitalia, San Paolo IMI. Some of these have merged since then. Then banks and institutions. This is the governor at that time of the Bank of Italy and the logo of the bank. Then government, and here we see our beloved Berlusconi and some other prime ministers who were in charge during the Parmalat times. Then the auditors, Sanders and Poor's, Grant Thornton and Deloitte, who were the consultants. And then suppliers like Tetra Pak, workers and investors. So what Tanzi wanted to do was to grow a big multinationals out of producing and selling milk, which is not an easy thing to do because the margin on milk is very low. So what he did was to go to the banks and say, look, I need some money to grow because I want to, you know, expand in yogurts, in snacks and other things. Okay, yes, that seems to be a good idea. This is what the bank said. And so they gave him some money. And then Callisto went back to the banks and asked for some more money. So one times, two times, three times, nth times. At the nth plus one time, the bank said, Callisto, look, are you sure that you are able to give the money back to us? I don't know. Let me talk to the CFO. And the CFO said, no. We will not be able to give you the money back. But we can do one thing. We can issue some bonds, and you banks can help us to place these bonds in the market. And they said, no, you know what, this is a good idea. Why don't we do this? And so they started to issue bonds, knowing that basically Parmalat was already almost bankrupt or close to bankruptcy, or in any case, it was not a good in a good shape. Was the Bank of Italy overseeing this process? Possibly not, and for two reasons. The first is an institutional reason, in a sense. The Bank of Italy is owned by the Italian banks, like in the USA. I mean, the Federal Reserve is owned by the banking system, which is a way of governing the financial system. So, in a sense, this idea of independence of controllers over controller simply does not exist institutionally, but it does not exist even practically, because Fazio was a close friend of many of the bankers, and in another scandal, what we heard phone conversations where they were talking about who should buy a bank and who should own a bank and so forth and so on. So this idea of the fact that there are independent institutions that can control and guarantee the transparency of financial transactions is simply a dream. And of course, in Italy, this is even more evident. The government, guess in which area of Italy Parmalat had the largest or one of the largest Italian investment in Campania, which is the region where Ciriaco de Mita is from. So basically what Tanzi was doing was investing in Campania to make sure that the electorate that would elect Mr. De Mita to the parliament were happy. De Mita was a Christian Democrat. Massimo D'Alema, who is there, apparently he received some favors. I think he could fly on the private jet of Mr. Tanzi, is from the left wing. And of course, what we have then is Berlusconi. Does he have an interest in making all of these relationships between these various actors more transparent? Of course not. Then what we have is the rating agencies and the auditors, Standard & Poor's, Grant Thornton, and Deloitte were the auditors. Could they make these relationships more transparent? Of course not, because if they said something about Parmalat, they would have lost also the other clients, i.e. the banks. So what I'm trying to say here is that the accounting framework and the way in which the accounting framework frames the actor in the market, or tries to represent these actors, makes a lot of other relationships obscure and not transparent. You could think, okay, Paolo, this happens in Italy, and so the Italians behave in this way, but the others do not. Not necessarily, because apparently what happens was also that Tetra Pak, which is a Swedish, I think, company, was helping Mr. Tanzi to bring some money away from Italy. How? They were selling the packs to Parmalat at 10, but they were cashing only 7. Three was sent to some bank account offshore in the Cayman Islands. Because, of course, what are we seeing here? And wasn't Carlista Tanzi aware of this process? Of course he was. I mean, the Parma scandal is an interesting example of how shareholders, and in this particular case, Mr. Tanzi, was not at all interested in maximizing shareholders' value. He was interested in many other things. I mean, for instance, part of the scandal also involves the Vatican and the Opus Dei. He was interested in many other things than maximizing shareholders' value, and Parmalat was a key instrument through which the entire Italian political system was sustained through Tanzi, and how he could shift money from banks to political parties. So the way in which the accounting framework frames these actors in the market is really too simplistic, and makes us do not believe and not seeing some of the important relationships which are happening there. This is in Italian, but I can translate it. So what is the truth about Parmalat? I want the truth about Parmalat. Do you want it whole or semi-schemed? This is the thing there. So what is the the truth about Parmalat. No one knows. I mean, this is just a partial story that I took from a book that is published by a couple of journalists from La Repubblica, and I have reshaped it in accounting terms. But I think that we can learn a lot from this scandal in terms of what it means to believe in transparency and trying to achieve transparency. The first thing, and here I'm relying on the work of Marilyn Strathern, transparency presupposes what we want to make transparent. So, in a sense, if you believe that shareholders are all about maximizing shareholders' value, you would make an accounting system that targets shareholders' value its maximization. But of course, you will lose other things that you do not think are important to see. The other thing that is very interesting is that transparency, independence, market competition, control always fail or are incomplete. But the more they fail, the more we like them. I mean, last year I was at Stanford. There was a very interesting workshop. I think one of the organizers is here today on the capitalist crisis, on the crisis of capitalism. And at the first of these events, there was a Marxist and a finance professor. At the end, believe it or not, both of them agreed that what was need for exiting from the crisis was more market. So the market fails, but what is the solution to the failure of the market? More market. Transparency fails. What is the regulatory response to make sure that we avoid scandals like Parmalat, Enron, or all the others? We want to make things more transparent. I think that this is a problem, and this is something that we should try to avoid. So what we can learn from this, and what we can learn from this picture, what do you see there? You see Rialto's Bridge in Venice, you see a gondola, but what you do not see, or you see not very well, is the artist. Okay, so he's there, he's standing there in between the camera and the gondola and the Rialto's Bridge. So what can we learn from Lewis Pauline's lesson? What he's warning us is exactly this idea that we believe in transparency. And if we believe in transparency, we actually concentrate only on what we set up to see. I mean, we try to monitor what a shareholder is supposed to do. We try to monitor what a manager is supposed to do, but we do not monitor for what the manager could do, and we do not know that he or she could have done. Then another thing that is interesting, Jeffrey Pfeffer came to IE last year and he said, it is not what we do not know, but what we believe that we know that creates problems. So in the accounting framework, we believe that we are able to make the important transactions visible, but what in fact, and so if we apply the accounting standards in the proper way, we are okay. We tick the box and we believe that we have done our job. But in fact, it is exactly that the problem, that we oversee what is really important and going on behind the scene or behind the veil of transparency that we have constructed. So in a sense, what we can learn from looking at these pictures here is La Scala in Milan. So transparency can be deceptive. It can be deceptive because if we go back to the previous picture, if we want to get the gondola, we run towards it and we do not see that the artist is standing in between us and the gondola. And so if we believe that we have everything in place and we then go straight to achieve our objectives, we do not realize that there are other things that are important and we are overlooking. The other thing is that not necessarily transparency is good. We saw this in the recent financial crisis. In a sense, at one point it was better, and possibly it is still like that, it is better not to be too transparent, because otherwise the market would collapse immediately because we would see what is really going on. The other thing is that not necessarily, and I don't want to argue here that transparency is bad, believing in transparency is bad. And so there are other ways in which transparency can be achieved. And denying the possibility of transparency is the only way of getting some of it. This is what I would try to argue. So what is the role that accounting plays in organizations and society, and how can we redesign the role of accounting in organizations and society if we do not take transparency as the goal that we want to achieve? This is taken from a paper that Anthony Hopwood and some other guys wrote back in the 80s. And they said, okay, if we know where we want to go, so if we are sure about our objectives and if we are sure about the means or how we get there, accounting works as an answer machine. And this is also how most of finance tools are designed. Think about discounting cash flows. You put some data into the Excel spreadsheet and you get an answer out of it. So invest, do not invest. Buy these shares, do not buy the shares. So if we are pretty sure about the environment in which we are, then accounting works as an answer machine. It tries to solve problems by computation. Of course, this is not something that we achieve in reality. This is not something that exists. A situation like this does not exist in reality, but it does underpin many accounting tools and many finance tools and techniques. What is more likely to happen is that, in fact, we do not know what our objectives or we do not know we do not know what our objectives are in organizations. Organizations are very complex. They are political. There are political battles there, and therefore, accounting in that situation works in practice as an ammunition machine, where numbers are used for negotiation rather than for representing reality. Or if we do not have a clue of what our objectives are, if we do not know how we got there, accounting is used ex post to rationalize how we got to that decision, for instance. Or accounting can be used as a learning machine, whether we know where we want to go, but we are not sure exactly how. And this is how, for instance, budgets work in practice. I think that we need to move beyond these four boxes there. And one thing that I would like to share with you is reflect about what, in a sense, create value nowadays, and what the role of accounting would be in this new scenario. If we think of, this is a very schematic representation, and to some extent it ends up with some which is very fashionable, but it helps to introduce the other argument that I have there. So we can define the history of the economy in four large phases. The first one would be the pre-industrial revolution. What creates value there is basically managing your assets. You have a farm, you manage the farm, and you get the results out of that. What does accounting represent? It represents through the balance sheet these assets. How does the value behave in that particular economic system? The value is pretty stable over time. There are no lot of fluctuations. I remember some work I do, some accounting history work, and before the Industrial Revolution, they did not even account for the assets because the value of the assets did not even depreciate. It was always there. I mean, there was not a need for accounting for the assets. What was the main notion of value that they believed in? The idea of realization value. Then with the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of the visible hand, managing processes and the role of managers was the key important thing. And of course, we shift the attention from assets to processes and therefore the income statement and how these processes create value. How does value behave? It behaves still in a quite stable form, but not as stable as before. What is the idea that drives the entire design of accounting system, the notion of historic cost because you want to evaluate performance and things like that. The market, capitalist market economy, what creates value? The market. So in the end, that is the end of accounting. If you talk to a finance professor would say that that accounting is completely useless because what defines value is happens in the market, not in the accounts. How does the value behave? Very volatile. And what is the idea of value that finance people believe in? Fair value. Okay. What happens after the crisis? What is the important thing to create value? I mean, one of the recent fads that we are witnessing is the idea of managing risks. So if we are good at managing risk, I mean, it doesn't matter whether we manage assets, whether we are good at managing processes, whether we are good at increasing the value of our shares in the market, what really matters is managing risk. What is the role that accounting could play in this kind of economy? We do not know yet exactly. And how does the value behave? I think that one of the important things that we may have to do is possibly to shift from having accounting reports that focus on one single number to ranges where the idea of value could range in between two extremes, and possibly rather than having one single number to identify profit, we may have a range of numbers to identify profit, and in this way we could possibly start a discussion about what in the end defines and produces a certain level of profit. What is the idea of value that we could work with? Possibly the idea of risk-adjusted value, although I am not that convinced about this, but we can talk this about this in the discussion possibly. So when I use these things in a course on managing measure programs, and one of my students told me, look, Paolo, this is interesting because in measure programs we do not know what we do not know. So if we live in a risk in a society where risk is the key issue, we do not know what causes risk. We do not know where the problems can arise from. And so in what I would like to explore is how can we take seriously the fact not only that we then when we account for something we are within this process of representation as it is exemplified by this representation by Escher, where the person in the picture gallery is within the picture that he is observing. But also the fact that this representation is always incomplete, and therefore we do not have a complete picture. And in my view, I think that what we need to concentrate upon is exactly on this black spot that we have in this Escher's lithography. So what we could not see is what is at the margin, what is marginalized by the accounting framework that we put in place is what needs to, or what requires greater attention, not what the accounting framework is able to represent, but what the accounting framework is not able to represent. If we go back to the initial story about the Parmalat scandal, what is missing from the first slide is exactly what is most important to understand the Parmalat scandal. So all those relationships which are made obscure by the way in which we represent stakeholders in the market. And therefore, I think that one of the key issues that we should consider in designing new accounting systems for contemporary organizations and society is not to aim for an accounting system that gives us solutions, that gives us answers. So we interrogate the oracle and the oracle tell us this is the right thing you should do. No, I think that what an accounting system should try to do is to raise questions, to instill doubt in the user. So it's a completely opposite, approach respect to what nowadays inspires the regulators and inspires the mainstream finance theory, for instance. So assuming that we have the impossibility of representation, for me, is a way through which we can actually have a better representation rather than a worse representation. And Yesterday, Bob, but also Graham, talked about the relationships between what we are discussing and also religion. I will continue this possibly tomorrow in my other presentation, but I think that doubt is an antidote towards believing that accounting can be the solution to all of our information problems. I would like to read with you this quote from the curator of the Tate Modern, who says, when you look at the building of the Tate Modern in London, you feel very small in the face of magnitude of this cathedral. It sends messages for miles. This is important. This is a sacred place. Everything here is sacred. Things that are sacred are not questions, and that is the problem. What accounting does at the moment is not raising questions, is to provide you with certainties. You have followed the accounting standards, you have followed the tick, and you think that the data that you're using are actually good, and therefore you make decisions out of that mystical belief in the numbers. Instead, if the accounting framework could instill doubts in you, that would be much more useful. I'm finishing. I remember also when I was in Oxford in 2008 when the crisis started to be visible, and I had money with iSafe, the Icelandic bank. Most of my colleagues had money with the Icelandic banks, and what some of my colleagues did to understand where to put the money was to go back and look at the statements of the banks, something that we would not have thought before. So once we start to have doubt, we do more work to understand what reality could be rather than less. And this is another quote that I found fascinating. Religion is integralist. Science instead leaves of the search for truth. This is Umberto Veronesi, a famous Italian oncologist who also was nominated for the Nobel Prize, which I find this quite a religious statement. Some of my colleagues in finance really believe that finance is all about searching truth. But searching truth is not something that we do. We try to solve practical problems. Searching truth is something that a theologian would do, possibly, but not me, not an accountant. So nothing to do with truth. So what I would like to do tomorrow, for instance, is explore this link that Bob and Graham mentioned yesterday, to look at business studies in general, but also accounting in particular, as a form of postmodern religion, unless we doubt. Okay. So very quickly and a bit rushed, but I hope that I gave you some insight on what I would like to do with this idea of embrace of doubt. Thank you.